It's the 24th yurt site of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that is this evening and tomorrow. And therefore, when I had to choose the topic for today's talk, I decided that would be particularly appropriate to try to speak about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And I'm going to say, when I say various things, we're going to approach this from a couple of different levels. One of the difficulties of speaking about Rabbi Soloveitchik is that he was exceedingly multifaceted. The other problem with speaking Rabbi Soloveitchik is that the way I would describe it is the way that the Gemara describes sometimes relationships and says that a certain Rav saw the back of another Rav. So when they say they saw his back, what they mean by that is that they did not see the full greatness. They saw him towards the end of the days. And I studied with Rabbi Soloveitchik in the early 80s when he was, well, not quite his early 80s, but he was born in 1903, so he was in his late 70s at the time. And he was not a well person then. He had been a cancer survivor. He had Parkinson's, and aside from other medical challenges at the time. And nonetheless, he continued, and he came to class, and he gave shiur, and it was really, in a certain sense, considering his physical condition, he really was quite heroic to be able to engage young students and be prepared and to teach on the level that he was teaching. And it was something which, on the one hand, I'm sure that we greatly appreciated. On the other hand, I think it was part of what kept him alive and vibrant, that ability to be able to engage and to teach. Rabbi Soloveitchik was many, many things for many, many people. And there has been somewhat of a tug of war for the true Rabbi Soloveitchik. And I think that certain people have been, and I'm not going to get into details on this, but certain people have been guilty of, shall we say, recreating him in their own image, right? That, which is somewhat of a problem. Although a lot of what has been said and has been written has not been so much a question of recasting or reinterpreting, but as much as looking at a very small part of the person and the personality. So if somebody, and perhaps this is acute in terms of people who live in Israel, people who live in Israel would only have seen Rabbi Soloveitchik in terms of his writings in Hebrew, which would be a smaller set of his larger writings. And again, as the years go by, he has become more and more prolific, and as the years go by, more and more things get translated. So that gets dealt with, but if you think about it, there were for many years a very limited Rabbi Soloveitchik who was known in Israel, and among what was known, for the most part, completely ignored what he spent the most of his time doing, and that was giving his daily Gemara shiur. So here you have somebody who's a Rebbe who teaches Gemara 3 times a week, 4 times a week, perhaps more, and then every 10, 20 years he puts out a major essay. So now how do you interpret the individual based upon the major essay which comes out, or based upon the day in and day out work which he had done? So I said that's part of the challenge in terms of people interpreting and understanding who he was. On the other hand, I'm quite convinced that he showed different people different parts of who he was. And I want to say one thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik never spoke, this will sound very funny what I'm about to say, he himself never gave a full-length, articulate description of Torah Umada. If you look at all of his essays, you look at all of his discussions, how would you describe Torah Umada? Torah together, science is too limited. It's on the other hand, modern orthodoxy is too unclear what this means. But this ability of living in multiple worlds is something which he never fully addressed straight on. I mean, I'm saying that would be a challenge to go through his writings and find the essay, the talk where he goes and speaks about Torah Umada. But on the other hand, everything that he spoke about, to a certain extent, was really Torah Umada. Look, for certain people, modern orthodoxy means, and I don't mean to be facetious, but modern orthodoxy is the situation where in the community the people are modern and the rabbi is orthodox. And with Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was that he was more sophisticated in terms of his readings, in terms of his knowledge, in terms of his awareness of the larger world than any of his congregants were. And it was somebody whose knowledge of, again, now you can just go down the line in terms of philosophy, literature, and you can keep on going down the line, was one which was immense. But now, who was he? So he himself was a person who primarily was, for lack of a better term, I would call him a Talmudist. But he was a Talmudist who was incredibly broad. And therefore, he could bring in references, again, from philosophy or literature, just in passing. And it was an authentic life that he lived, and an authentic, not saying that he may not be this lonely man of faith and so on, but there was an authentic life that he lived where he was able to reconcile all kinds of contradictions, and part of who he was living within what we can call the brisker derech, but taking it to a very, very different place, because he had a broader perspective than many of his cousins and uncles and grandfather, and therefore the reconciliation that he was dealing with was far broader than what Reb Chaim was dealing with. Because Reb Chaim was dealing with reconciliations in Talmudic discussions, and he was dealing with reconciliations between Judaism and a modern world. So it was the same methodology, but it was being used on a different type of a canvas. And he was somebody who was producing masterpieces, if we will extend that metaphor. So what I want to do is I want to talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'm going to tell a story, and then we'll learn something from him, which we'll see will be connected in some way to the story. Of course, in the most indirect way possible. Rabbi Soloveitchik was often attacked. He was attacked for real reasons and for imagined reasons. By the way, don't get me wrong, he was also incredibly revered. He was not just revered, he was somebody who was looked up to, and he was somebody who was loved. Even though he was like a caged lion in class sometimes, but still what he gave to his students, what he gave to his followers, the fact that he was able to confront modernity and to come out victorious gave a lot of his followers this feeling, I don't know as much as him, and he was able to emerge with his faith intact, so therefore who am I to question and who am I to feel challenged, so therefore his experience was one which gave a lot of faith to others. But as I said, he was challenged for real and imagined reasons. I mean, one whole area of where an attack would come from was from what we would call, for lack of a better term, the ultra-Orthodox camp, or the Orthodox community, who found his engagement with modernity something which was quite frightening. And therefore, if one could, instead of engaging, one could determine to make believe that that larger world does not exist, or that larger outside world is not one that needs to be confronted, or we could just will it into non-existence, make believe it's not there, sort of... I guess Rabbi Soloveitchik, if we're asked, probably would have called it to have a Don Quixote experience and just make believe that all these things are not there and live in your own world, so then, wonderful. But the fact that he was involved with YU, the fact that he was involved in Zionism, that's one strike and those are two strikes. And therefore it opened it up to attack from different places. And sometimes the attacks were actually more imagined than real. I want to read to you another attack, which will come from a very strange place. I'll tell you exactly who it was who penned this and who he wrote it to, because some of you may know both of the people involved. But first, a prelude to this. When Reb Chaim took over the world, I say the world, you know, sometimes we get carried away. Jewish world is not all that big. I don't know, I would call it a world. It's, you know, if it was a country, it'd be a very small country. But the yeshiva world, as they say, Reb Chaim created a revolution. And what Reb Chaim did is that he allowed people who were sophisticated in terms of their thought processes to be able to use that sophistication in terms of learning. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was very fond of saying that Reb Chaim was as sophisticated as any of the professors. In fact, he once told the story about how a former student of Reb Chaim had later become a student of Einstein. And then he said... I heard this from him directly. And he said, and then I asked the question that everyone always wanted to know, which of course no one ever wanted to know other than Rabbi Soloveitchik. He says, who was the greater genius, Reb Chaim or Einstein? And the fellow thought and he answered. He goes, Einstein was the greater genius in terms of one particular area, but Reb Chaim in terms of all other areas, the way that he was able to look at all kinds of things. And one, of course, doesn't know if that was the answer that he gave his grandson or that was what he really believed. But Reb Chaim was most certainly an unusual type of genius. There's a book written, it's called the Marcheshes, or some of you, the Marcheshet. The Marcheshes was written by the oldest dayan in Vilna before the war. His name was Rav Chanoch Egis, and Egis. And he writes in his introduction to his book either something which is very sad or something which is said very tongue-in-cheek. And he writes that I learned in yeshiva before this new type of learning came into the world. And I don't know this new learning all that well, but my book is still pretty good, so you should learn it anyway. So it sounds like, it sounds almost like an apology. Reb Chaim was challenged much more by the Ridvaz, who spent a short amount of time in Chicago, and then a great amount of time in Tzfat. He was one of the chief adversaries of Rav Kook in terms of the Hetem Mechira, and he called Reb Chaim, he called him a chemist, that he was involved in science and he wasn't involved in learning. He said that in a quite pejorative manner. So the letter that I'm going to read to you is written by a man whose name is Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, as many rabbis, is better known by the name of his book, which is the Sri Deish. And he wrote this letter, actually there are two letters here. One was in Tafshin Kav Hei, the other Tafshin Kav Vav. They were both written to a person in Jerusalem, I'll tell you in a second. The Sri Deish himself had an interesting life. He, as the name of his book sounds, Sri Deish, he was a survivor. And he ended up in Switzerland, where he spent his last years. And there was a young man from Switzerland who made Aliyah, who was born in 1932, and then he moved to Israel in 1950, at the age of 17, he moved to Israel. But apparently he still retained a close relationship with the Sri Deish, and as I said, I will ask him this, Billy Nander, next time I see him. I know I haven't told you who he is yet, but I will ask him when I see him what the relationship was, but it's clear to me he must have known him from Switzerland. His name is Gabi Cohen, or Gavriel Chaim Cohen, Gabi Cohen, doctor, rabbi, Yakir Yerushalayim, Gabi Cohen, who was the head of Machon Gold for many years, teaches still in Bar Ilan University. And the letter from Tafshin Kaf Hei, he writes to, I'll put it this way, the Sri Deish writes to Gabi, and he writes and says as follows, I'm appreciative of Gabi Cohen for giving me my first teaching job in Israel, which goes back to 1987. Kfar no'azti v'amarti l'hagon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I had the audacity to say to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Oviv shel Hagrid, right, the father of Rabbi Soloveitchik, Shechidushei Torah shel Ovi Hagon Reb Chaim, Heim Emet v'chinat ha'higayon. Reb Chaim's Torah is true in terms of logic, of a lom v'chinat emet ha'historit, but they suffer because they're not historically true. Reb Chaim had derech limud acheret mishel Rambam. Reb Chaim had a different way of learning than the Rambam. And every time Reb Chaim tries to explain a Rambam, all that he did is he gave you, a soliloquy, and not an interpretation of the Rambam. And that was the attack of the Sri Deish. And that was nothing compared to the attack that he then gives a year later. He writes as follows to Gabi, as I said, this is from Yud Tet Kislev, for some of you that date may be important, for Yud Tet Kislev Tafshin Kavav. Karati et mamaro shel Hagrid Soloveitchik al dodo Hagriz Zatzal. I read, and this is the eulogy that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave for his uncle, for the Griz, for Velvel. Hasafa hi nehedra v'ne'adra v'asignon hu maksim. That the language is uplifting, it's beautiful, and the style is one which is enchanting. Aval hatochen hu mugzam u'mufuraz ma'od. But the substance is one which is exaggerated and is carried away. Kach kotvim anashim ba'alei kat. People who are members of a cult write like this. Kimo anshei chabad u'balei musar. Like members of Chabad and members of the Musar movement. Mitoch mamaro mitkabel aroshim ki'ilu ha'tor lo natna demosh rabbeinu chalila ki'ima yedei Reb Chaim mibrisk zatzal. One gets the impression when reading this that Torah was not given to Moshe at Sinai, but Torah was given to Reb Chaim. Emet hadrim ki Reb Chaim, his rim zerim chadash shel pilpul, notice he uses the word pilpul, that Reb Chaim infused the life of pilpul, that ha'higayon li'yeshivot, by giving him new kinds of logic and learning to yeshivot, b'higayon yesh l'kol adam chaylek. When it comes to logic, every single person has a part of logic. U'lefich chicholim kol b'nei yeshiva l'chadesh chidushim b'signon zeh. And therefore, all people who are sitting and learning, when it comes to logic, they can say something logical. Masha'ein came, which is not the case, b'derech hashach v'rikiv eger, sarich liot baki gadol b'shvil liot k'tzat charif. You want to follow the approach of Rav Akiva Eger, or of the Shach, you actually have to know a lot of Torah before you can say something. And all the kids who learn in yeshiva, they want to say chidushim, on top of all the other classical Talmudic scholars who preceded him. Sha'alti pam, and here's the point, Sha'alti pamachad et agrid biotober Berlin. When Rabbi Soloveitchik was still a student in Berlin, I asked him, mi gadol mi mi, who's greater, Hagra mi Vilna or Reb Chaim mi Brisk? Who was greater, the Vilna Gaon or Reb Chaim? V'hu anani, and he responded, ki binogeya la havana, Reb Chaim gadol af mi Agra. When it came to an analytical ability, understanding, Reb Chaim was greater than the Gra. So then the Sri Deyesh ends off his letter, Avalokein Hadavar, but that's just not true. Hagrama Vakesha te emet hapshuta la'amita. The Gra is always looking for truth. Valokein Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim's not looking for truth. Hegyoni v'sfarati einam mishtalvim lo b'lashon ha'gemara v'lashon ha'rambam. Reb Chaim's chidushim don't fit into the Gemara, and they don't fit into the Rambam. Reb Chaim hoyel sh'ka'atzmo Rambam chadash. Reb Chaim was he wrote a new Rambam. Avalom Farish HaRambam, he never succeeded in interpreting the Rambam. Kach Ramayki Lagon Rav Moshe Zal, Avisha Lagrid, Shlita, and I said that to his father as well. So now, I guess you were not anticipating such a scathing attack on Reb Chaim. And Rav Moshe. And by extension, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Part of what he suffered by was that he was the heir. And he was the heir. Rabbi Soloveitchik was the oldest grandson of Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim had seen his notebook of Chidushei Torah and was, as far as the story goes, was wildly excited about it. When the notebook arrived, he showed it to the Dayan of Vilna, Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, and he shows him, he goes, this is the Chidushim of my grandson, again, who may not have been bar mitzvah yet. And in a certain sense, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's future was assured. He, again, unusual genius, unusual matmid, unusual creativity, and in a certain sense, the soul of Reb Chaim continued, and that's what Rav Kook said when he met him. During the last months of Kook's life was the same time that Rabbi Soloveitchik had made his only trip to Israel, and I had heard this story from Rav Avram Shapiro, who later became the chief rabbi, when he had visited New York, and he walked into the Beis Medrash in YU to give a shiur, and Rabbi Soloveitchik came in at some point, and when he walked in, he stopped, he walked over, and he kissed him. And he said to the students, it's a halacha, you have to kiss a Sefer Torah, how much more so a walking Sefer Torah? And he said, I want to tell you something, a story which happened all those years ago, when Rabbi Soloveitchik came to visit Rav Kook, he sat with him, and they spoke in learning, and when he walked out of the room, Rav Kook said to me and to Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he said, it's as if Reb Chaim is still alive. He goes, he has the soul of Reb Chaim. He has the intellect of Reb Chaim. It was as if I just now spoke to Reb Chaim again. And remember that Rav Kook learnt in Volozhin. He learnt in Volozhin when Reb Chaim was there. And he said, this was as if this was Reb Chaim. And he then told Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Avram, every shir he gives while he's in Eretz Yisrael, make sure you go to the shir. And they said they followed him around every single stop of the way to hear all of the shirim that he gave. And he came and he said, I want to say thank you. He goes, over the years, again, Rav Ram is speaking, people have told me how successful I am as a Rosh Hashiva, as a Magid Shir. He said, whenever people would say this to me, he would say, you think I'm good? I'm nothing. But there's a Magid Shir who's in America. His name is Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. He's a Magid Shir. I'm just trying to say over Torah to my Talmidim. Which also tells you something about the modesty of Rav Ram. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's future is really, in a certain sense, it's assured, but the world was an interesting world at the time. And this will sound funny, but his father, I told you, his father had some sins. One of the sins of his father, Rav Moshe, was that he was a Zionist. And because he was a Zionist, he was blackballed in Europe. And this will sound even funnier, because he was blackballed in Europe, in order to get a proper job, he had to come to America. I know all of you are thinking that there may, if you're a Zionist, there may be another possibility, but he was not the first that that happened to. He in reality took over the position for the Meitzer Eloi, who had also had the same sin. He was perhaps Reb Chaim's greatest student, and he also, because he had taught in a place which had Zionist associations, he also couldn't get a job afterwards in Europe, and he had to come to America, and he passed away tragically very young. What a lot of people don't know is that he was replaced by Rav Shimon Shkop, who, I know that's a shock to, who was visiting America, and then he ended up giving shir until the Chafetz Chaim yelled at him, come back to Europe, what are you doing over there? And then Rav Moshe Soloveitchik took over. Okay, so full stop. Rav Moshe has one sin, he's a Zionist. His son, Rav Yosef Dov, has another sin, and what's that? He goes to university. So while he's in the University of Berlin, just in case you're wondering what he did with his free time, we have the records today, what he did with his free time. We have the correspondence. We have the letters that went back and forth between father and son, and you can see exactly what he was involved in. He was writing Chiddushei Torah on a level that I can assure you 99.9, and I'm being kind now, percent of the Rosh Yeshivas in the world are not writing those kinds of Chiddushei Torah today. That's what he was doing in his spare time while he was in Berlin pursuing his degree. He sends to his father something he was thinking about, something he was working on. He solved a problem within a Rambam, which was, till that point, quite difficult. If you want, I can tell you exactly what it is, but I will lose all of you. The question became within the Rambam, why when it comes to matanot aniyim, to giving certain gifts to the poor that one has to give out of one's fruit, why the criteria, well, let me put it this way, why the law is different in certain applications than the laws of Truma? There just seems to be some separate laws, and why are they different? And he went and tried to reconcile it by saying is that they have two different definitions in what a fruit is. And when it came to Truma and Maser, there was a Gzeret HaKatuv, therefore that taught that Truma had a certain law. But when it came to the Matnot Kuna, then it had to be, have what was called a Shem Pri, which was not exactly the same, and that was the Chiddush that he had said. So he wrote this over to his father. By the way, whether his father agreed or not is a whole subject to a whole other question, because actually his father responded to him, and he responded back. And there is, as I said, we have today a book which is the Igeret of the Grid Vahagram, the letters that went back and forth between the two of them. So we see this correspondence. But his father decided, as some proud fathers will, his father was invited to a convention of rabbis and decided to get up and to say over from his son the Chiddush that his son had just sent him. So after he says over the Chiddush, he was then asked to write it down and publish it in Hapardes. So it gets published in this journal called Hapardes in 1931. Quickly enough, a journal which is put out in Vilna, which is called Knesset Yisrael, or Knesset Yisrael, has a rejoinder. And somebody comes in, and a fellow's name is Rav, his name is Shlomo Cohen. By the way, Shlomo Cohen can sound like a very anonymous name. Shlomo Cohen comes and he responds and he tries to attack every single thing that was written over there. Among the things which are interesting about his response is he never mentions Rabbi Soloveitchik. He mentions that there's something published in this journal, and he mentions the father's name. And even though the father in the next line says, I heard this from my son, but that he leaves out completely. And he goes and he attacks the father, and he writes this essay attacking him. So you may ask yourselves, why is this important? Well, it's important for a very simple reason. It was the first time that Rabbi Soloveitchik was attacked in writing. Was an essay the last time? No. But what's more interesting is who this Shlomo Cohen is. Shlomo Cohen is actually a real person who lived in Vilna. Not only was he a real person who lived in Vilna, his father lived in Vilna. And his grandfather lived in Vilna, and his great-grandfather lived in Vilna. His grandfather's name was, this is going to be very predictable, was Shlomo Cohen. Harav Shlomo Cohen, who was a dayan in Vilna. His father was a dayan in Vilna. He had a great-uncle, Rav Bezalel Cohen, who was a dayan in Vilna. Matter of fact, Rav Bezalel Cohen's writings ended up making it into the back of the Vilna Shas, which may or may not be related to the point that he had another uncle who was the one who actually was the one for the Shas Ram, who actually put all of the, who edited for them. So this Rav Shlomo Cohen was well known, but I would say as follows, based upon the rest of his literary career, as far as I can tell, it's very difficult to believe that Rav Shlomo Cohen actually wrote this article. And we pretty much know that it wasn't him, but it was his chavruta who wrote the article. He had a chavruta who he used to learn with, and his chavruta was a very interesting man. And by the way, you all know who he is. His chavruta was somebody who liked to learn with young people who did not learn in yeshivas or didn't make it in yeshivas, because this young person was completely convinced that anybody learned in yeshivas would be confused and not know how to learn, which, by the way, sounds very much, again, like an anti-brisk and an anti-yeshiva. But this person's name was Rabbi Avraham Yeshayahu Karlitz, the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish wrote the article against Rabbi Soloveitchik. And again, what's interesting about this is on a couple of levels. One is that the Chazon Ish was the Chazon Ish already, but he wouldn't sign his name. And probably he wouldn't sign his name because he didn't want to give him enough credit even for having written it. And later on, the stipler told people that the Chazon Ish did not believe that the son wrote it. It's that the father wrote it. And the father wrote it in order to try to help his son get some kind of a shteller. By the way, Hayudvar Me'olam. I can show you books that were written by fathers to help their sons get jobs. And he was completely convinced of this, because after all, how possible could it be that this young maskil sitting in Berlin could have actually written this? And the other thing which is very funny is that the Chazon Ish did the exact thing that he accused of doing. He accused Rav Moshe Soloveitchik of writing it so that Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik gets the credit. So here he gave Shlomo Cohen the credit for writing what he really had written himself. Rabbi Soloveitchik responded elegantly. The response of the Chazon Ish was in Adar of 1932. Rabbi Soloveitchik responded within a month in Adar Beis and said, I'd like to thank Harav Hagon Rav Shlomo Cohen. By the way, I have no doubt, I mean, this is my own gut, I have no doubt that he knew exactly what was going on. The Soloveitchiks had plenty of knowledge of what was going on in Vilna. Rabbi Soloveitchik had visited Vilna. He knew most of the Gdolim in Vilna, and he probably knew exactly when it was coming. Shlomo Cohen wrote this thing, and it just didn't make any sense. And who is Shlomo Cohen? Oh, he sits and he learns with the Chazon Ish. He's the Chazon Ish's chavrusa. A matter of fact, Knesset Yisrael was published by the Chazon Ish's brother, Moshe. As a matter of fact, Shlomo Cohen was a nephew of the Chazon Ish's other brother, Meir. So there was no question who was behind all of this, and the Chazon Ish was very fond of writing in this Knesset Yisrael anonymously. In that effect, he not only wrote anonymously, he most likely wrote anonymously, and then responded anonymously to the first article that he wrote anonymously. And by the way, the Chazon Ish wrote his first couple of books, Chazon Ish, and people did not know who it was. But he signed his name Ish in a number of things, and the Chazon Ish decided to go after Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he said the reason he went after the father, forget out the son, he went after the father in order to show people that Mizrachim, right, people part of the Mizrahi, cannot possibly have knowledge of Torah. And therefore, he decided that he had to go after him to disprove him. Rabbi Soloveitchik then writes his elegant response, and he says, I'd like to thank Harav Shlomo Cohen, Harav Hagon Shlomo Cohen, for reading my words, for reading what I wrote. I'm so pleased that the words that I wrote have made its way into the Batei Medrash, and people are learning what I wrote, and people are considering my ideas, and I hope that for many years to come, you'll keep on learning things that I wrote, and keep on then, and this should continue. And then he completely rips him apart. He completely rips him apart, and I'll leave it to anybody who wants. I can send you both articles, and you can decide for yourselves who won this particular battle. If it was the Rav as a college student in Berlin, or if it was the Chazon Ish, who was the Chazon Ish at the time. But the Chazon Ish in this particular thing was so bent on just disproving I mean, one of the lines there, again, it just pops out of my head right now, one of the lines there is Rav Soloveitchik writes back, that which you accused me of making up, I don't know how you missed it, but all the Rishonim and Achronim say this. The Tosfos Rid said this, and this said this, and this said this. I don't know why you're accusing me. This is something which was... Who? Rav Soloveitchik over here understood that there was a war going on. Sometimes in war, one needs to respond. And the war over here was an attack against his father. Just that the article never touched him. It was against his father, and he went and made sure right away to say, the article that I wrote, I'm very happy that is being studied in order to set that record straight as well. But let me continue then. As I said, I want to try to learn a piece from the Rav as well. As I said, that particular thing was a sugya in Zroyim having to do with fruit, truma, maisrot, matan anim, but I wanted to come back and do something which is actually connected to Pesach. And what's beautiful about this particular piece is that it is from Rabbi Soloveitchik and from his father, who he was very fond of quoting. He would quote his father, quote his grandfather. When the Rav passed away, his brother of Aaron said that the two of them, his father and his brother, he said that it was an unusual relationship in terms of Jewish history, in the sense that very rarely do you have two people that are two generations who are so close. He said it's almost like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Lezer, who sat in the cave for 3 years. He goes, at some point, one doesn't even know what the father said or what the son said, what the son said, what the father said, because the two of them were chavrusas and they learned together. Again, for all the years that they studied, Rabbi Soloveitchik never really went to yeshiva. He never really had any other Rebbe other than his father. And from his father, he received the teachings of Reb Chaim. And oh, by the way, I'll tell you a story that a number of years where someone published the Chidushim of Reb Chaim on Baba Metzia. Now, Reb Chaim never wrote Chidushim of Baba Metzia, but he had a notebook. His notebook was when he taught in Volozhin and he gave the shiur. He had his own notebook of a, never prepared for print, never. But when, I believe this is the way that it went, that when Rav Moshe was going to get his first shtetl, Rav Chaim said, he may have to give shiur and let me give you my notebook. So we gave him the notebook. The notebook ended up sitting in Rabbi Soloveitchik's safe for many years. And everybody knew that Rabbi Soloveitchik, he told people, I have the manuscript of my grand. So people were expecting Reb Chaim, but you know what? It wasn't Reb Chaim. It was Reb Chaim when he was a young man, which was not the same thing as the fully developed Reb Chaim. So somebody got their hands on it from Bnei Brak. I don't know exactly how. One could guess how these things happen, but they published it. And, okay. It's nice shiurim, but it wasn't the fully developed Reb Chaim. Because, you know, even people like Reb Chaim have a time when they're young and a time when they're more mature. Okay. So, what I'm shifting gears, and I want to teach something from the Rav that has to do with Pesach, that has to do with Matzah, that has to do with the problem, which as I get to it, to the problem part of it, then I hopefully will describe it better. I'm going to start with the Shulchan Aruch and work backwards. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Ein lashin matzo mitzvah, v'lo ofin oto ayidei einu yehudi, v'lo yedei chereshot v'katan." That when it comes to making matzah, you can't do the kneading nor the baking by somebody who's not a Jew, or by somebody who's chereshot v'katan, essentially somebody who's lacking what we would call das, dat. The person does not have the proper intention, which therefore means, let's say the other way around, the making of matzah requires a person to be able to have the proper intention. You would now expect the next thing to be that when you make matzah, you need to say, l'shem mitzvot matzah, that this thing is being done for the proper thing. And as I said, the Shulchan Aruch says, ein lashin matzah mitzvah lo ofen otah yidei einu yehudi v'lo yidei chereshot v'katon. That's the halacha. You go back one step, you look in the Torah. The Torah writes the same thing. Ein osin hamatzot ayidei akum chereshot v'katon. And he quotes a little bit of the sources for this, which I will hold back for a second. The Rush, who's the father of the Torah, says the exact same thing. He says, but he gives us a little more information, because now he goes into custom. V'nagu ba'ashkenaz v'tzorfat l'shomran, to guard, that's not the matzo yet, it's the flour, mishat tchina, from the time that it was ground, lafi sha'az makriven otan el hamayim shetochin birechayim shamayim. So that's very interesting. Why do you need to guard them? Because they were using water mills. So water and flour may be great for many things, but it's not good for your matzah. Rav Alfas katav mivoyle linaturi kimcha depeska mishat ktsira. And the Rif says that you needed to guard it from the time that it was cut. Now, there's a very big question in terms of what is shmur matzah, from which time you need to guard them. Good. Dichtiv v'shmartim et ha-matzot. U'v'shiltot, now this was the source, the shiltot, those of us who don't know what it is, the shiltot is written by one of the Gaonim, Rabbi Chai Gaon. The shiltot was a book which took Talmudic sources and divided it into the weekly parsha. So therefore, theoretically, you can go through a good deal of Shas by reading through, learning through the shiltot every week. U'v'shiltot, parsha tzav, Katav lo nafak inish yedei chovato el b'matza de mintarle michimutz min denafla maya olayu. That a person can only fulfill their commandments if it's guarded from the time, as we guard from the time that water touches the flour. Veheicha de imtune lechite nachri chere shotav katan lo nafak yedei chovato. And if it was guarded from the time that the water hit it, a non-Jew, or Chayr Shotav Katan, somebody who could not have proper intention, proper dat, he says that person did not fulfill their commandment of eating matzah. So therefore, if you want to know what Shmur Matzah is, Shmur Matzah would be not just that it's not chametz, it's not just that on a chemical or physical level it's not chametz, that Shmur Matzah is, according to what the Shiel Tod is telling us, that we have to make sure that it was guarded by somebody who understands the Shem Mitzvah Matzah, and it has to be guarded all the way through. Right? I read the Shilta, it's quoted by the Rush. I'll read it in the Shilta right now, sorry. The lo nafik yidei chavote ele b'matzah deminter lei michimutz l'shum matzah, the Shem Matzah, michinof l'may Allah. It has to be for the intention of matzah from the time that the water falls on it. The heichi damtuni l'chite goy ocher shot v'katan delav b'nei shimur ninhu. That person did not fulfill the commandment. Okay. So, just one quick question now. This obligation to make sure that somebody is guarding the matzah, the flour, did it say it in the Gemara? Did the Gemara actually say that? So, all that you can answer me right now is that you don't know. It's interesting, it made its way to the Shulchan Aruch. It's right, made its way to the Shulchan Aruch from the Rush, through the Tor, into the Shulchan Aruch, black and white in the Shulchan Aruch, but did the Gemara really say it? So, let's listen to what the Gemara says. So I'm reading now the Gemara in Pesachim Daf Lamed Chet. The Gemara says, Chala toda v'rikike nazir v'chule, and that's quoting the Mishnah. The Mishnah said, you can't use for Pesach something which is physically kosher l'Pesach if it was baked for a nazir. Which means within the process of being a nazir, there's also certain matzah which is being used, called there rikike nazir. The Gemara says you can't use it. Why not? Minane mile. How do I know this? Amar Rabba de Amar Kra v'shmartam et ha-matzot. You need to guard the matzot. Matzah ha-mishtameret l'shem matzah. You need matzah which are for matzah. Yotz tazu she'ein mishtameret l'shem matzah el l'shem zevach. So let me explain to you what the Gemara just now said. So hopefully this will make a little sense. The Gemara did what the Gemara does. And what's that? The Gemara has what's called a limud. It learns something. What's the limud that it has? The limud that it's trying to do is to exclude the use of matzah designated for sacrificial use. When I say sacrificial use, I mean specifically for the nazir. And it learned this from a verse, u'shmartem et ha-matzah. So you have to, and by the way, the shmartem over here does not mean guard. What does it mean? It's more, what? It's to designate. Okay, to designate. Which, now, okay. That.
Watching the mind, I mean, the process.
Right, but all that the Gemara learned here from the Limud, all that it learned from the verse over here was, again, l'shem matzah, and not l'shem zevach. The Gemara goes on a little bit further, and again, d'tanya kavati d'rabba, yochi yitzei yidei chovato b'chalot todah, V'rikike nazir, maybe you would think that you can use something used for the korban todah, which, by the way, had both matzah and chametz, maybe the korban todah, or a kike nazir, or I'll call it a cracker used, I would say a wafer, but that would sound like someone else, can use for a rikike nazir. So it says, Talmud lomar ushmartem et matzot, matzah hamishtamer l'shem matzah. That it has to be for matzah. Yotz tazu she'ena mishtaberet l'shem matzah el l'shem zevach. Rashi writes over here that we here foresee that matzah needs intention. You need to have it l'shem matzah, l'shem mitzvah. So now, if you're a good brisker, what do you do next? Actually, you could have skipped Rashi, but if you're a good brisker, what do you do next? You look at the Rambam. So the Rambam writes as follows, and this is the Rambam in Hilchot Chametz Matzah. Chalot toda, v'rikike nazir, sha'asa otan la'atzmo. If somebody made the wafers, crackers, matzot, but they made them for the korban toda or for the nazir, ein yotzim behem, you cannot fulfill your obligation with these. Shenemar ushmartem et matzot. Because we learned that's what the verse means when it says ushmartem et matzot, to guard the matzot. Matzah mishtameret le'inyan matzah bilvad. He sheyotzinba, you can only fulfill your obligation with that. Avozusha mishtameret le'inyan hazevach, but something used for the korban, for the nazir. No. Ve'imason lemkor bashuk, and if you make them just to sell them in the shuk, hareze yotzinba yidei chavato, then you can fulfill your obligation. Now that was a very interesting phrase in the middle, because you're making them to sell it, why are you making them to sell it? So he writes, Sha'oslam korbashuk bedatosh im lo yimkuru yochal otan v'nimtza b'shat asidam shomram l'shei matzah. It's very convoluted language that the Rambam used over here, but I have to stress one thing. How did the Rambam understand the language of shmartim et matzot? Let me give you a parallel. The Mishnah Berurah writes why it's proper to leave your tzitzis out. He says, re'itam oto. Right? Re'itam oto. You should see them, so you need to have your tzitzis out. Most Gedolim in Europe did not have their tzitzis out. Didn't they know? First of all, did they know the Mishnah Berurah? The answer is no, they didn't know the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah didn't become popular until much later. Somebody once asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, do you have to wear your tzitzis out? And he said, no. No, of course, why doesn't he think you have to? Because there's no place that says you have to have it out. So somebody said, but it says re'itam oto. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, either knowing the Mishnah Berurah said it or not, he said, whoever claims that a re'itam oto means that you have to air your tzitzis out, you should suspect that they're a Karaite. You should suspect that they're a Karaite. Why? Because they're taking the Torah literally. And we don't learn it literally. How do we learn it? We learn it. What do we learn from re'itam oto? That you need it during the day and not during the night. That your clothing for the day and not your pajamas need tzitzit. Re'itam oto, that's how Chazal learn it. If that's how Chazal learn it, that's what it means to us. And if somebody says you have to wear it out because it says re'itam oto, which is a drasha that does not exist in Chazal. Chazal never said re'itam oto means you need to wear your tzitzit out. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, if somebody claims that's what the verse means, you have to suspect that they're a Karaite. So as I said, either knowing or not knowing that the Mishnah Berurah says it is re'itam oto, of course you have to have it out, which I'm sure made a great deal of sense to somebody or to many people over the years, but there just happens not to be a drasha like that. And I want to go back to this drasha. What did the Gemara do with the drasha ushmartim et matzot? It means that it has to be designated. So now you have to be careful. Is it that it has to be designated for matzah, or did the Gemara learn that it can't be designated for the nazir? So how did we understand that? Yes, was that too subtle, or should I say it again? Ushmartim et matzot. Did it tell you that it must be designated for matzah, or did it just come to teach me that it can't be designated for the nazir? So now you have all the information you need, and now I'll read to you what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. He starts off with, in a shir that he gave, he starts off actually with a reading from a machloket between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai in the Yerushalmi. So I'll read a little bit. B'Yerushalmi Tana, matzah yeshana plukta to Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. What's matzah yeshana? Matzah from last year. You'll have the various books talking about this. Are you allowed to use last year's matzah? And who saves it? You know how expensive this stuff is? Okay. Who saves it? You save it. Are you allowed to use last year's matzah? So what? So that's the question. Can you use last year's matzah, or is there some kind of a problem with your last year's matzah? So there's a machloket Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. Amar Rav, divrei hakol hu mekevon shelo asa l'shem pesach davar hu shelo dikdak ba ad kan l'shono. So first he's starting Tosfot had quoted that Yerushalmi and saying, but it's not being made for Pesach. That's very strange. It was made for Pesach. It was just made for last year's Pesach. So the fact it was last year's Pesach, how does that affect me at all? Ulam aliba de Beit Hillel, because according to Beit Hillel, gama matzah she'ena suya l'shma k'sher l'mitzvah. But Beit Hillel says matzah which isn't l'shma is okay. Matzah doesn't have to be l'shma. It just has to be not chametz. That's enough. But according to the end of the sugi in the Rishalmi, even Beit Hillel agrees that you shouldn't use old matzah. By the way, the question again will be why? According to the conclusion of Rishalmi, it's not because it's lacking that I had dedication, intention for this year, but rather the problem was that maybe it wasn't guarded over the year, that it didn't come in contact with chametz. Again, just remember, in the time of the Yerushalmi, they didn't have plastic, okay? They didn't have Ziploc bags. They didn't have packaging. So you have matzah, which lasts for a year. So what are you afraid of? You're afraid that it came in contact with bread, with crumbs, whatever. So the problem over here is not shimur. When you made it, it's not a question of kavana. The Yerushalmi comes to the conclusion, according to Beit Hillel, you can't use old matzah because who guarded their matzah all year? Again, all year we have chametz in our house, so how can we possibly be sure that no chametz came in there? But this has nothing to do with intention. He then quotes our Gemara, quotes the Rashi. Rashi says, Elashono, kol shimur shata mishamur lo shelo tachnitz hitkavin l'shem matzah shel mitzvah to be in shimur l'shem mitzvah. Right? So that's Rashi. It can't be for the nazir, l'shem mitzvah. Then he says, and what he's trying to do over here is to reconcile Beit Hillel with the Bavli. And he's going to do that by interpreting the Rambam a little differently, but then I want, there's something really important at the end that we need to understand, and I hope I'm not losing you. He says, "Achinira shar Rambam cholek bizel Rashi." It seems that the Rambam has a completely different understanding. And according to the Rambam, it comes out, there is no argument between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. And then it says in parentheses here, I took this from the Rishimot Shirim of Rav Soloveitchik on Sukkah, and it says here in parentheses that this particular idea he taught in the name of his father, Rav Moshe. And he says that when the Rambam says that it can't be Chalut Nazir, what the Rambam means by this is it doesn't have to be Lishma L'shem Matzah. All that it means is that it can't be for Nazir. That if it's as if to say is that Lishma Tamata Matzot, v'lo rikike nazir, it's matzot, v'lo korban toda. That the way the Gemara learns the limud is saying it's exclusionary. Matzah can't be for these other mitzvot. That makes it not good for Pesach, but it doesn't tell me I have to have kavana for the matzah. Skipping a whole bunch over here, what he ended up doing, therefore, is then claiming that if that's the case, then the Bavli didn't say you need shimur, because the Yerushalmi doesn't. Hillel says, you're allowed to use old matzah, but the only problem is that it may be chametz. I mean, it's not that it was lacking any kind of kavana. So then he comes and he says, okay, finally, let's get to the point where this will all suddenly become very important, and I know that the Nazir doesn't concern us so much, and the Korban Todah doesn't concern us so much, but then he comes out and he says, and therefore, you know what's going to be the big nafkamin of all this? That matzah doesn't need to be l'shem matzah. And he says, if that's the case, the whole fight they had about the machine matzahs, and I want to stop. Some of us were here this morning, I spoke about machine matzah. So let me just pause for 1 second now. When the machine matzahs were first made, the first machines, the big concern was that it was chametz. How can machines work, and so on and so forth. Okay, full stop. After people came to the realization that it wasn't chametz, then a whole new objection came. And what was the new objection? That it's not l'shem matzah. How can you have kavana? It's a machine making it. And if the Shulchan Aruch writes, Chayr Shotev HaKatun can't do it, so then how can a machine make matzah? You can't be yotzei with a machine. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, but hold it a second. Remember I started with the Shulchan Aruch and I said, let's go back to the Torah and let's go back to Ra. All of those were based on the Shiltot. The Shiltot made a drasha that doesn't exist in the Gemara. What's the drasha in the Gemara? The drasha in the Gemara is that what does Shemar Tumatza Matzot mean? It means Matzot, but not for something else. How did Rashi understand that? You need Kavana. How did the Rambam understand it? It can't be for a Nazir. So then Rabbi Soloveitchik ends up saying, therefore, any objection to the machine matzah, because there was no kavana, is no objection, because the Rambam never said this. The Rambam had the Bavli open in front of him, never understood it that way, that it needs to have this type of intention, and that's the case. There is no psul, there's no invalidation, of because Acher, Shota, and Katan were running the... We're making the matzah, or for that matter, certainly the machine. The machine can't be puzzled because there was never anything that you needed to be shomer. So, again, I never discussed it with him, and I never heard him discuss. No, did you ever hear him discuss machine matzahs versus hand matzah? But my suspicion would be, if I knew how his mind worked, my suspicion would be that this would be one of his considerations in the back of his mind. That he would look at the two, again, on the one hand, what would be important for him would be tradition. What his father did or his grandfather did could be incredibly significant. On the other hand, he would go back to the Rambam. His father had this great understanding of the Rambam, and what was the understanding of the Rambam? That the Rambam never required Shimur in the way that others understood it, and therefore the Rambam would not agree with this whole sif in the Shulchan Aruch, which is based upon the Shilto, which is based on something which is not in the Bavli. Now again, is this the easiest thing in the world, just to throw aside something in the Shulchan Aruch? No. It's not an easy thing to do. Would the Vilna Gaon do it occasionally? Yes, the Vilna Gaon would. And by the way, most of the time, why would the Vilna Gaon do it if it didn't make sense in terms of the Sugya and the Bavli itself? So I'm saying over here, what ended up happening, and again, maybe it sounded a little complicated in terms of Nazir, Toder, Korban, this, but what ended up coming out of the whole thing? It ended up coming out of the whole thing is that I just now have an added reason to feel quite confident that the machine matzot are completely good, and the objections that people imagined that existed, according to the Rambam, at least the way that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik understood that Rambam, is that whole objection fell apart completely, and there's no objection to the fact that it was made by a machine without a person saying L'shem Mitzvah Matzah. I said, you can say L'shem Mitzvah Matzah. But believe me, in the matzah factories, there's L'shem Mitzvah Matzah on every single on every single step of the way, there's L'shem Mitzvah Matzah. According to what the Rambam is saying, is that L'shem Mitzvah Matzah was not necessary whatsoever. What I wanted to do, but I think the way that he would have understood it, I don't have to worry that it was made for the Nazir. I think that's the way he would understand it, because that's how he had the limud there. Right. Because that's how he had the limud from the beginning. Again, what I wanted to do is to, again, speak a little bit about Rabbi Soloveitchik, but I also want you to get a taste, a little bit, of the learning, and it was important to me that it be specifically learning having to do with Pesach, and anybody who's using their machine matzah, which I think in all kinds of reasons are absolutely superior. I'm sorry, machines are superior to human beings. I'm sorry for saying this. But this removes another one of the objections that people imagine may exist. So I think that's why I thought that was very interesting as well.